I want to just remind our listeners that we are speaking to Dr. Gary Habermas, the author of The Case for the Resurrection of Jesus. He's been kind enough to appear on the Naked Zoo News Review this morning. Do we have to do a quick station check?
We don't. We should remind people that they are listening to KWMR, 90.5 FM in Point Reyes Station, 89.3 in Bolinas. All our phone lines are tied up, but if you would like to get a question to Dr. Habermas and you have access to email, you can send email to nakedzoo@gmail.com. Adam is monitoring that screen assiduously. And we will put your question before the good doctor.
Yeah, I think that's enough of my sort of musings off to the side. I think we should get back to the book, which was a...
I have one more musing, though. I just have to keep doing this because this is so evocative for me. This discussion of the translations, it mirrors perfectly a stretch of the road in my path coming to faith, which was that exact question. I ended up with like seven Bibles, including one like a 17th century Bible that I found in an old store in a King James, and then a book that has four Bible translations side by side in it, with so you can just read across the page and read the same. And I couldn't find a penny's worth of meaningful difference.
In fact, Adam, I would just say to you, let's say you and I we're the two guys doing the talking, and you're the skeptic, and I'm the Christian. I'd say, hey, well, look, Adam. If that bothers you at all, you pick. I would want it to be a good scholar. I wouldn't want to be some guy off the wall who can't read Greek and he's going to tell me what the English says. But let's just say he's a good scholar. I do not care if you use a New Testament written by an evangelical translation or not evangelical. In fact, the non-evangelical translations, in my estimation, you'd be reading things like the English Bible, the New Revised Standard Version of the Bible. I'd say read it. In fact, if you can bear a real brief story, for a few semesters, I went to a Christian college. I went to a secular school, and then I transferred to a Christian college. And when I was studying Old Testament in this Christian college, the professor said, you guys need to read the Old Testament in order to take this course. And he said, you pick your translation. Here's the three or four translations I want you to use. One of them was the, quote, liberal translation, and it was just laid out there on the table, and it was absolutely, and by the way, it was the one I chose. So it's fine if we wanted to read that. So I would just say, you know, you pick your translation, and that's okay with me. Just make sure the guy knows, you know, that he's a scholar, that he knows the difference between Greek and English, and we're good to go.
This is one sort of a digression on a digression, but I think it's important that we cover this, or at least it's of interest to me. Doctor, were you raised in faith, or did you, what is your own history of coming to Jesus, if I may?
Sure. I was raised in a Christian home, but when I became a teenager, I went through a very, very strong period of doubt. Lasted for about 10 years. Matter of fact, I've written a couple books on doubt, not because I'm, you know, the great expert in this field, but to reflect the fact that I was really up against it for a while. And I used to picture dying, and it was always this time of year, at least out here in the East. And, you know, the leaves would be changing, and I'd be in the ground, and the leaves would be blowing over my grave, kind of Edgar Allan Poe style, and there'd be no meaning to life, and there would be no, you know, no life after death. And one day after I finished my grad school, my doctorate at Michigan State, my mom called me, because she's a very committed Christian, and called me and said, how are you come with all your questions? Because she used to come down at 1 o'clock in the morning, and I'd still be studying in my room. And she'd say, man, can't you go up these questions? And I was coming home with all these incredible books, like The Passover Plot and books that just said the Bible's ridiculous. And she said, can't you give it up for a while? And I said, no, really, I can't. And she called me after I finished grad school, and she said, how are you coming? And I said, well, I said, tell you the truth, I think I'm a few months from becoming a Buddhist. So that was at the end of my 10-year struggle. So although I was raised in a Christian home, I just went through a stage where I said, you know, if I can't know that there's some basis for these things, if all there is faith, then that's just not good enough for me. And so I really, and by the way, that's how I got on the subject of the resurrection. I tried several other subjects that Christian friends said, oh, here's this great evidence, here's that great evidence, look at Noah's Ark, check this out, do this, here's prophecy. And to be real honest with you, I found virtually nothing. But there's some good arguments for God's existence, but as far as the Bible and specifically Christianity, there was almost no evidence that I thought was just super. And then I settled on the resurrection, and before I even started, it just seemed kind of prima facie to me that if the resurrection occurred, well, then, yeah, since that's gospel, I guess we're getting pretty close to the heart of Christianity. I started with that assumption, but it took me probably 8 years of studying the resurrection before I came to the conclusion that historically it's defensible. I went through a stage during those 10 years where I walked away from it, and I thought, I can't get to the bottom of this. But at that time, I didn't know a whole lot about what was going on in critical thought, and I thought I did, and I thought critics were saying this and that, and I found out later they weren't. But anyway, I came from through a Christian background, but I came, in my own mind, I was pretty close to walking away from it.
Well, thank you for those 8 years. You made the walk of shorter for a lot others of us who could walk in your footsteps. Let's look at, we're getting past half the show, and we haven't said anything much about Jesus' death by crucifixion, except that the disciple, we've said the disciples, James and Paul, all described and are accepted by scholars to describe and believe that they had an experience of the risen Jesus.
Right.
So, there's your minimal fact. What do we make with that?
What do we do with the fact that they thought they saw Jesus?
In short, so what?
Yeah, that is the key fact. And the reason it's so important is because if they're right, everything in Christianity hinges on it, and if they're right that they saw the risen Jesus, that is the gospel, because if you have a risen man, that presupposes he died, so now you have a died and risen man. And when Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians 15:3, which is the most evidential, everybody will tell you is the most highly evidential passage on this New Testament, Paul doesn't call him Jesus, he calls him Christ, and when he, which is a title, and when he talks about him, he usually calls him Lord, which is the Old Testament translation for God, and or Christ. And so you basically have what Christians call the gospel, the deity, the death, the resurrection of Jesus. Now if someone doesn't concede the resurrection, you don't have the other. So when you say, well, let's zero in on the disciples thought they saw the risen Jesus, first thing we have to concede is, like I did when I was going through doubt, I would say, well, look, I'll tell you this much I agree with. If you pull this one off, you've got the gospel. If you can't pull it off, I have more than a valid right to question everything else you're saying. And that was the ground we went to. Now, that particular fact is one of the ones that's conceded by probably more scholars than any other fact in the New Testament. In fact, I wrote recently.
This is the crucifixion?
No, that the disciples believe.
Oh, the disciples believe.
Right. That's probably. I just said recently for a journal that's a non-evangelical journal, I just published an article, came out days ago. And I said that the three best known facts from the life of Christ that probably everybody will agree to, believer and unbeliever, is what he taught. His chief teaching was the kingdom of God and how to get there. He didn't just say, I'm telling you about the kingdom. He said, what you do with me determines whether you get in or not. That's one. Two, he died. And three, the disciples thought they saw him recently, afterwards. In fact, Ed Sanders, a guy at a professor at Duke who calls himself a liberal, Ed Sanders, when he gives a list of what he thinks are the things we could know about Jesus, one of the facts he lists is the disciples saw Jesus after his death. And then he says, I don't know how they saw him or what he looked like, but they saw him. And so I would say about that fact, disciples thought they saw the risen Jesus. Paul thought he saw the risen Jesus. James, the skeptic, thought he saw the risen Jesus. Everything hinges on whether they did or not. And I would say, if you've got Jesus dying, which, I mean, five people out of 2,200 dispute in this survey. If you got Jesus dying and you got disciples believing he was raised from the dead, the major question is, what do we do with these facts on the table? And so the question is, can I explain the disciples believing they saw Jesus by another cogent way beyond the fact that they really did see the risen Jesus? And that's what it's all about. I would say, in a nutshell, if you've got guys who believe they've seen the risen Jesus, and there's a variety of reasons to believe that they believe that, that's why 99% of scholars concede it, and if I can't poke a hole in it, in other words, if I can't explain it any other way than that they've seen the risen Jesus, then if I'm a skeptic and want to stay a skeptic, I'm in trouble. That's the key.
Because centuries of people have now more or less blunted themselves trying to produce that parallel explanation that you could look at and say, well, that's possible.
That's right.
And if that's possible, then I don't have to accept this supernatural intervention of God one, because I have a perfectly logical, natural, acceptable,
right.
And that doesn't exist in the minds of this huge majority of scholars.
Yeah, well, back to my 2,200 sources.
2,200.
On the resurrection in the last 30 years. German, French, and English, the three major research languages. I've counted, and if the guys who think other explanations of that fact are possible, you have about 40 scholars. That's it. 40 scholars out of these 2,200 sources who think they can come up with some other explanation other than the disciples really saw the risen Jesus.
Are these 40 guys adherents of one or more of the objections that you actually deal with in the book?
Yes.
And respond to?
Yes.
Try us on one, just for...
Well,
so
for
people
example,
understand what you're saying.
All right, so probably the most popular... Okay, what's the most popular mean? That 10...
of the 40.
10 out of 2,200. Yeah, the most popular one is to say the disciples saw hallucinations. In other words, yeah, this guy died. Yeah, he said these incredible things that you think he said, like there's a kingdom and you better square with me because what you do with me determines where you spend eternity. No problem. He really died. Yep, no problem. And the disciples really thought they saw him. No problem. The reason these guys are saying these 10, the reason they thought they saw is because they saw hallucinations. So what you have to do is you wade in there with these facts that are on the table, data that we all concede, to ask if the hallucination theory works. And the vast majority of scholars, in fact, I have a long footnote in the recent publication where I list critical scholars, not evangelicals, who think the resurrection is ridiculous, that they think hallucination is ridiculous according to the data we have, and it's, you know, dozens.
Well, and according to everything from psychology that we understand about
right.
the nature of hallucination.
Right. That's the problem.
That's the problem.
I think it's important to point out that's the case that you make is that a hallucination tends to be a very individual activity.
Exactly. That's
and
important.
Very much in the eye of the beholder, and that when you have, very rarely do you have mass hallucinations. Although you do point out I thought it was very brave of you to talk about sort of alien sightings, that you do get these, that we do have this record of a lot of people seeing things that would also fall into sort of a supernatural category, but those things have other explanations.
Right. Now, take your alien or your UFO. That's the difference, and we try to point this out. A lot of people, and I'm not saying you're doing this, but a lot of people, when they say, oh, yeah, hallucination, mass hallucinations are rare. No, they're not rare. I just have a clinical psychologist buddy. He teaches in a PhD program in clinical psychology. He just did a lit review, a review of all the literature on the subject, and he said there's not a single scientific case of a mass hallucination. Now you say, well, okay, which, by the way, would be really tough to say the disciples saw Jesus. But you go, well, wait a minute, what about these UFO things? Ah, that's not an hallucination. What I mean is we could talk about that, but it's a different category. That's what you'd call an illusion. An illusion would be a typical example. I come in late at night, 3 o'clock in the morning after speaking somewhere. I'm really, really beat. I take my coat off. I hang it on my post at the bottom of the bed. I take a hat off, put on top of the post, jump into bed, and I wake up in the middle of the night, think somebody's standing at the bottom of my bed. And then I turn the light on, and my heart's beating like crazy, and I go, oh, it's my coat and my hat. That's not an hallucination. I'm not hallucinating a person. I am taking my coat and my hat to be a person. So that UFO thing, when people start saying, oh, it's gas, or it's a weather balloon, or it's a Air Force whatever, or it really is a UFO, those are all discussions about really seeing something and how we interpret the data, as opposed to hallucination, which is exactly the opposite. Hallucination is a much more radical principle. You're looking at thin air and saying you see something in the thin air, as opposed to there's a cigar-shaped object in the sky. Well, maybe there's a cigar-shaped object in the sky, but that's not hallucination.
I think something
is there.
One of the arguments that holds some sway for me is the predisposition of people in this time period to believe in miracles, and you know they were in a environment, a supercharged religious environment in which miracles were alleged by lots of people in lots of different places.
Sure.
And that even in the Gospels themselves, they talk about when Jesus appeared, they didn't recognize him. You know, there's what we're talking about is the assumption that these disciples said, yeah, okay, Jesus rose, I saw him. But there's a lot of talk, you know, there's also in the Bible where he appeared to them and they didn't believe that he was the Son of God, and they didn't believe he was Jesus for a while. They touched him, and that, I forget what the language was, but like he sort of made, he cast something over their eye.
Yeah. Well, there's two questions here. One is, aren't these people, is this kind of a supercharged atmosphere? And if it was, why didn't they believe, why didn't they recognize him after they saw him? I can address both briefly. I think the first one is the way to your objection. Supercharged atmosphere. These people weren't terribly critical. Now, interestingly enough, this is just an aside, sort of a footnote if you're doing a paper. If you're going to talk about the Gospels and say, look, these people are seeing God, these guys are seeing miracles all over the place. Interestingly enough, the Greco-Roman historians do the same thing. In almost every major Greco-Roman history, they report miracles. Okay, that's interesting. And you say, well, all the more. What about my question? Well, a second side thing, footnote, would be that the Gospels also present cases where supernatural things happen and the people go, no way. For example, three times God speaks from heaven and he says, this is my beloved son in whom I'm well pleased. Well, in John 12, which is the most derided of the Gospels, but it's also the one with the least miracles, when God speaks from heaven and says, my beloved son in whom I'm well pleased, it says some of the people stand there said, it's thundering. Somebody else said, an angel spoke. And anyway, the point is, even then, they would try other explanations before they'd accept God. But still, your question remains, are they a gullible people? I'll tell you what, let me just concede, for the sake of the argument, let me concede that they're a gullible people. We still have to deal with the fact that this gullible people thought they saw the risen Jesus. And I'd say, Adam, that counts for you. It counts for you that these people are somewhat gullible. So, since they're somewhat gullible, and they think they saw the risen Jesus, let's try to come up with something else that would explain their belief in terms of, there's got to be an extra natural explanation, right? If that's not a UFO, what is it? If this is not a resurrected Jesus, what is it? The catchy thing is, as you see from the book, is that no matter what you say, well, what really happened was fill in the blank, you're in trouble. When I debate guys very frequently, they will not pick a theory. They will not tell me what they think really happened, what the disciples really saw. And I'll say, why don't you? And one guy said, well, because if I pick a theory, you're going to get me in a corner. And I said, hey, wait a minute. I'm the supernaturalist. You're the naturalist. I'm telling you it was a resurrection. You say no. I'm saying God raised Jesus. You're saying question mark. You should at least not be afraid to put your thesis on the table. If naturalism is so plausible, and if these guys being so gullible is so obvious, you should be able to tell me what really happened. No, not going to do that. You get me in a corner. Well, if I'm going to get you in a corner when you pick a theory, so much the worse for your theory. So to say they're gullible begins to count against them until you weigh in there and say, what else could happen? And besides, Adam, you've got, what would you do with Paul? Or what you would do with James, who were not believers until they saw the risen Jesus?
I think it's interesting that you bring up Paul. I do want to say that we did get an email. We've got about 12 minutes left in the show.
Okay.
Again, to reiterate, we're talking to Dr. Gary Habermas, the author of The Case for the Resurrection of Jesus. And it is a highly incensed email from one of our loyal listeners.
Okay.
But the main point of it, and I want to sort of address this to both of you, because I think one of the reasons that you're on the show is because of my father's conversion experience.
Uh-huh.
And the fact that it comes up in a lot of conversations with us. What is the topic, which I think is our fault for not framing it a little bit better, other than a sort of a extended book review? And two, why should I care? Why should I care about what we're discussing right now? And I think that's a more potent question.
I would say,
can I take the first part of the framing of the what's the topic?
Sure.
And put in the context that I'd like to think this show is in, and that is that we make an effort to bring the readers, the listeners, information about a range of topics that they're not likely to run across from other media outlets. And this, mainly that's politics, as I said earlier. We do some sports, we do politics, and we are looking for sources of information that give a perspective on current events and current developments that is not is available other places, but you're not likely to find it unless you go out and search it for it. And I regard this information about the availability of an intellectual evidentiary case to be made for the historicity and existence of Jesus as that kind of information that if you're not out looking for it, you're not likely to run into it. And I will give to you, why do we care?
Yeah. Adam, I think that that is, back when I was going through my doubts, this is the heartbeat of what I would be trying to answer, because who gives a rip? If why spend 10 years, and then that was just to get into the ballpark, the rest of my life studying the game, why do this if the game's not worth watching or if I don't care about the game? To me, here, this is the key issue, and I love to talk about this because it seems to me if we get to this issue, we're doing pretty well. Because I know this. I know when you're on a talk show, it's kind of hit and miss because you have, you know, someone brings up this issue, someone brings it, and here comes an email, and here comes a question. It doesn't necessarily mean this, but sometimes when you get the importance question, it's because they think, wow, he does have a point, but why should I care? And I'd say, okay, well, great, great. If I have a point, then, you know, we're not talking about the most crucial things. So if I don't have a point, then I don't care, let alone the guy who's writing in. But if I do have a point, now we do get to the care question. And I would say for most people in the world, if you read surveys, most people in the world are concerned with meaning in life. No matter where they come down on the issue, they're concerned about the fact of meaning. And there are arguments, even by non-believers, that I'll cite one. A psychologist who says the loftiest idea ever penned by a human is that there could possibly be life after death. That is the most meaningful question in the universe. And then his very next sentence is, too bad there isn't any. But he concedes, even though he dismisses the afterlife, he concedes that that if there was an afterlife, it'd be the most meaningful question there is. The reason I think resurrection is so incredibly important is because Jesus comes and he says, hey, there's a kingdom out there. It's starting right now. Phase one is now. Phase two is in the future after you die. And I want to give you a remedy. It basically concerns me and what you do with me, as I said earlier, in particular the deity, death, and resurrection of Jesus. What you do with me determines where you spend eternity. A person can reject that. They can reject his answer. But on the evidential side, you got a potential case where the resurrection evidences his message, because if he was raised from the dead, dead men don't do much. If he was raised from the dead, he couldn't have done it himself. He would be acted upon by somebody else who acted upon him. We don't know how to raise the dead. But whoever acted upon him would presumably agree with his message. You don't raise somebody from the dead you don't agree with, especially when it's the only time in history. So right away we're saying, here's what's on the line. Is what he taught true? And the resurrection would seem to say, if it happened, then his central message, here's the kingdom of God, or the kingdom of heaven, as Matthew calls it, here's the kingdom of heaven and how you can get in. If he's raised from the dead, I better start listening. So to me, this would answer this, potentially answer the most central question, or what some people would say the most central question. Now, if your reader, your listener, says, I don't give a rip, I don't care if there's life after death at all, then I would say, hey, I don't lose the argument because you don't care. You just don't care. And so, you know, we can quit talking. That's okay. But I'm happy to talk to those who do care about this. And my guess is, that's a much higher percentage of people than those who don't care, even unbelievers. So I'd say what's on the line here is the possibility of life after death. And I'll just throw one more side thing in here. In 1995, my wife died of stomach cancer.
Oh.
We were very, very close. We had four kids at home. It was a devastating event in our family. And one of my grad students, who now has a PhD and he's a professor up at a college in Canada, he called me on the phone while my wife was dying. And he said, where would you be right now if it wasn't for the resurrection of Jesus? And I'm going to tell you what, facing my wife's death with the resurrection and facing my wife's death without the resurrection are two totally different things. The most impressive card, got a lot of cards from people, a lot of friends we didn't even know we had, got a card that said, I bet you can't wait for that day when heaven comes and you can walk hand in hand with your wife in the kingdom. And I'll tell you, Adam, I could not read the card. For weeks, I put the card away. I knew it was there. I was real happy with the card. When I rubber banded the cards together, I put that card on top, but I couldn't open it up and read it because it about killed me, absolutely killed me to read it. But one thing the card is right, it does make a difference if I'm going to see her again. So now for the very few people who say, I don't give a rip, it doesn't matter to me, then I'll say, then I guess it doesn't matter to you. That's all there is to it. It doesn't matter to you. But that doesn't say that what I'm saying about the resurrection is false. So what we need here is that we need a true resurrection to get Jesus' view of heaven. We need a true resurrection. And if someone exercises faith, by the way, faith just doesn't mean, yeah, I'll do it. Faith means, I tell my students the best analogy is I do, that we say in a wedding, I do, for better, for worse, rich or poor. It's a commitment. It's a life commitment. You got who Jesus is, and you say yes, and that's eternal life. Adam, anybody can disagree with me. I just think it's the most incredible, potentially true message in the universe.
Doctor, we've got about another minute because we need to clear the studio for the next show coming in. I want to thank you once again for the time you've taken. Is there any final thought you'd like to leave us with?
No, guys, I do a lot of interviews. And some of these interviews, the people aren't super well prepared sometimes. They'll say, oh, so your thesis in the book is the Bible's reliable. No, that's not my thing. But you guys have just done a really good job. And, Adam, I appreciate you coming on. I appreciate your questions. I appreciate you're very, very kind. You know, you don't have a chip on your shoulder.
I do.
You do, but not here. But, no, I appreciate the honesty with which you're coming. I say keep looking. Anybody who's listening, I say keep looking. There's nothing wrong with asking tough questions. I know, you know, as the old saying goes, been there, done it for a good 10 years and off and on after that. But I would say this. When you talk about the resurrection, you're not talking about something periphery. You're talking about something central to the meaning of our existence. If Jesus is Son of God, and if there's an afterlife, if it's his way, then, and we're talking evidence. We're not saying, hey, just believe. If there's evidence, then this is perhaps the most important thing we can discover. And that's what I found when my wife died in 1995, that was there for me, and I've been forever grateful to God.
We're on our, Doctor, thank you again. We're on our way out. Stay tuned for Ellen Shahade's Viewpoints, and we'll see you in 2 weeks for the Naked Zoo.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Have a great day.
Thank you.